Susan, I don't know whether we told you, but you are invited and urged to walk over to the fellowship hall and be over there this morning so that these people can welcome you again. Okay? If you can't see the red carnation, you can see the red coat. The carnation is rather lost. If you can imagine what it would be like to stand on a street corner in Beijing, China, and preach democracy, perhaps you can imagine what it was like for the Apostle Paul to preach a new definition of love to the city of Corinth. The city was famous already for love, but it was the kind called eros, the Greek word from which we get erotic. And they celebrated it in a great temple dedicated to the patron goddess of such love, Aphrodite, whose Greek name gave us our word aphrodisiac, and whose Roman name gave us our word venereal. Love in the port city of Corinth, as I have mentioned before in this group of sermons, was sensual and selfish. And against that kind of background, Paul had to define a new love, which he called agape. It's not an easy word to translate into English, where we use the one word, love, for everything from I love my new earrings, to I love my mother, and right on up to I love God. Paul's word has little to do with Valentine card sentiment or romance or the impulses of emotion. It means a special kind of determination. And although I've already tried out several definitions on you, I have one more that I think may be the best yet to keep handy in your head. Someone said, how about a definition of agape that is no more than three words long? So here it is. Agape love is undiscourageable goodwill. And this kind of love, Paul says in our text from 1 Corinthians 13, does not keep account of evil, nor does it gloat over the wickedness of other people. It could be that Paul means the same thing by both of those statements, but I'm going to pretend for a moment that he doesn't, and look at the second one first. Love, agape, that particular Christian attitude, which is at the heart of the entire Christian religion, does not gloat over the wickedness of other people. I suppose everyone in this room knows the temptation to feel a delicious little thrill of superiority when someone we are not fond of falls on his face. The Germans have a useful word for that feeling. They call it Schadenfreude, which can't be put into English perfectly, but means a malicious joy in the failures of other people. The malice may be intense, or it may be mild, but there is a kind of gleefulness that goes along with it. As the person on the telephone put it, you know I wouldn't say anything about anybody unless it was good, and boy, is this good. It is one of the ironies of the religious life that church people are sometimes worse about this kind of gloating than those who make no profession of faith at all. You get the feeling sometimes listening to some bridge table talk and some preachers that we get an unholy delight out of cataloging the whole world's moral sickness. My friend's wife stopped on a street corner the other day to chat with a woman who has a local reputation as an insatiable gossip. When his wife came back to where he was, my friend said, "What was Mrs. X talking about?" "Oh," his wife replied, "just business." "Yes, I know," he said, "but whose?" The fact is, we get excited about people we hardly know when the business of their life includes a scandal. So it was a huge challenge for Paul to say that agape love does not permit itself that pleasure. Because even in the little church he had established, there was enough scandal to keep tongues wagging 24 hours a day. There must have been some flinching when Paul insisted, "Love is never glad when others go wrong." We've all known people for whom that principle would take about half the fun out of life. People who report the news, whether on television or in the daily newspaper, understand this appetite. They know from scientific research that almost every reader or watcher is caught most quickly and held most firmly by a headline that promises scandal. I have edited a daily newspaper, and I have some notion of the good things a paper does for a community, but I also know how strong the pressure is to make an editor pray, "Give us this day our daily scandal." So we not only have the appetite to begin with, but it is whetted and fed every day. If the paper tries to counteract this hunger and runs a little department called Good News, which ours did for a while, it's unusual enough to make a special fuss about. I think ours died out, didn't it, a good while back? Or did I lose interest in it because it wasn't spicy? Why do I read the obituary notices and not the birth announcements? My regret about a death is genuine enough, but do I also feel just the least little bit of elation that the bad news is for somebody else? The sad truth is that Paul Revere's frantic midnight ride went at a snail's pace compared to the speed at which bad news or malicious gossip spreads. As a general rule, no one runs to the telephone to report the latest demonstration of noble character, but hands get hot for the dial when there is a juicy bit of gossip. It's irresistible. Even if we don't like to start it, we can't resist hearing it. And I'm standing on no high moral ground. I'm as susceptible as most people. If I say hello and someone says excitedly, "Have you heard the latest?" I have a quick double reaction. First, I'm pleased to know I'm getting the news quickly, whatever it may be. And second, I'm excited because I have seldom heard anyone ask me if I have heard the latest who didn't go ahead to tell me about a scandal. It's almost always titillating gossip that goes by the name of the latest. When was the last time someone called and asked if you had heard the latest and then went on to tell you about a thrilling reconciliation? between two separated friends, or about an unusual case of generosity. These will get told, but they can wait. It's only scandal that has itchy feet. Let's come back now to the first half of the verse I read at the beginning. Love does not keep score, does not keep a record of wrongs. A judgment that surely must make many of us a little uncomfortable, because one of the most common diseases of personality is that dismal bookkeeping which is determined to settle the score. Common, I suppose, because hardly anyone exists who doesn't have some kind of score to settle. In one of his original songs, the French composer Jacques Brel asks, "Who is the child with no complaint?" No answer is given because none is needed. Nearly all of us have some complaint and therefore some score to settle. Perhaps we feel our parents did not do well enough by us, or those who taught us, well, the D's and F's were not our fault. We blame our lost children and our broken marriages on the church. It let us down somehow. And if the larger issues do not touch us, we may be sore simply because our neighbor to the north refuses to rake and waits for a strong north wind to move the leaves from his lawn to ours. How tolerant we are about such things probably determines how healthy we are. When Reinhold Niebuhr was asked once by This Week magazine to choose the text from the Bible that meant most to him, he said it was this one from Ephesians. "And be kind one to another, tender-hearted, forgiving, even as God for Christ's sake has forgiven you." Now here's one definition of forgiveness. It's a decision to put up with an uneven score. It means that you have surrendered the right to get even. We'll have to talk more about forgiveness one of these days, but it might be useful to say in passing that it happens only when one person asks forgiveness and another grants it. You may be ready to forgive, but the action can't be completed until someone says, "I'm sorry, can you forgive me?" But the willingness to forgive is beautiful, even before that circle is complete. I suppose nothing so endears us to the memory of Abraham Lincoln as his readiness to forgive. I know some of you have heard how when he was a country lawyer, he was engaged as counsel in the famous Harvester case of McCormick versus Manning, and how he worked hard to prepare his brief so he could plead the case well when it came to trial. But at the last moment, the job was given to a more brilliant and polished attorney who said, "What does this long-armed baboon expect to do in this case?" And who then proceeded to use effectively the very notes Lincoln had spent so many tedious nights preparing. Well, some years later, the country lawyer became president, and set out to choose a cabinet. He remembered his brilliant colleague in the harvester case. He forgot the personal slights, and without hesitation, he appointed Edwin Stanton his Secretary of War. The common good was more important than keeping score and settling grudges. For most of us, it isn't. How differently we act, I can illustrate in a story that's true in every detail. A Jewish girl in Boston fell in love some years ago with a Catholic boy at a time when tensions between these two were about what they are in Boston today between blacks and whites. The parents of the girl reacted in a rather petty and spiteful way, but they were also concerned, because they loved her, about the real differences and difficulties the couple would have to face. They finally won out, and although she was old enough to marry without their consent, she broke the engagement. Within a couple of years, she learned the lesson that there is not just one man for every woman. She fell in love again, this time with a Jewish boy, and they decided to marry. Her parents happily planned a beautiful wedding and went to work on it months before the event. One weekend, the girl came home to make some final plans and invited her father to go shopping for her wedding dress. He was delighted. They shopped all over downtown Boston and bought the dress and the bridesmaids' gowns. When they got home, the girl asked her father if he enjoyed himself. He assured her that he had never had such fun. And then, her face turning to stone, she said, "Well, it's too bad you will not be seeing me in that dress." He asked what she meant. She said, "I won't need it because I'm already married." Completely stunned, her father asked what the shopping tour was all about. She said, "Before I left home, I wanted to do something that it would make it impossible ever for you to forget what you did to me 2 years ago. I could think of nothing more memorable than shopping for a wedding dress you would never see me wear." Well, she settled the score. I have no knowledge of her history after that. But I think I can promise one thing. If she lives a normal lifespan, there will be many sad hours when she will wish above everything on earth that she had let that cheap victory pass. If she had heard the apostle clearly and had loved better, she would have thrown away her account book. Agape love does not keep score. Now, if you need help with that, when someone has acted badly, look at that person and remember the good words of a very wise theologian. Almost every person you meet is fighting a great battle within. It can make such a stunning difference in some of your reactions. I want you to hear it once more. Almost every person you meet is fighting a great battle within. It's true, and it makes you able to forgive others.